morning and welcome to Shattering This. This program is devoted to those of you who know that there's something dreadfully wrong with the political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions which are governing and influencing our country and much of the world. We realize that these institutions are the problem, therefore they are not the solution. Our mission is accordingly to look behind the headlines to know who is perpetrating the tragedies that are besieging our planet, because based upon this plague of adverse political, religious, academic, military, media, and economic influence, we have at most 15 years until, well, the world as we know it no longer exists. All hell will be unleashed. We're going to experience a complete collapse of both economic and world structures as we know them. As a result of this, in our second hour, for those interested in avoiding this calamity, we're not going to sell you super seeds. We're not going to sell you perfect filters or homemade remedies. No, we're going to offer you what God has offered all of us, which is the opportunity to participate in His family, where He makes us perfect. He makes us immortal. He adopts us as His children, empowering and enriching us. That is the offer of a lifetime. And we'll dive right into the midst of His presentation of the covenant to Abram during our second hour today. For those who would like to participate in this program at any time to express your opinions, you're welcome to do so. The number is 877-300-7645. I'd like to begin today talking about the juxtaposition of religious and national holidays. Today must be a evidence that America is a Jewish state, because America's preeminent national holiday, political holiday, is now juxtaposed on the Jewish religion's most predominant holiday, Hanukkah. So if I were a religious individual or a patriotic individual, I would say that's proof of divine manipulation. Of course, it's nothing of the sort. Let's talk a little bit about Hanukkah, and then after we've described what Hanukkah represents, we'll turn to the story of Thanksgiving and the conditions that actually existed at the time that it was observed. First, before I begin, it looks like Larry has called in. Larry, welcome. Anytime you'd like to make a contribution, particularly to this first part on Hanukkah, I'd love for you to do so.
Okay.
Hanukkah is not scriptural. You will find absolutely no mention of anything even remotely related to Hanukkah in the Torah, much less the prophets. Search as you will, there is nothing related to it. It is commemorated in the Talmud, and it is mentioned in Maccabees. Maccabees is a book, as was the Talmud, written long after the last of the prophets were inspired by Yahweh. The war that it commemorates began in 165 BCE. Now, we're told by Jewish religious authorities that Hanukkah is not in recognition of the war or temporary victory over the Greek Syrians, but in fact was a in commemoration of a religiously proclaimed miracle. Yes, according to the Jewish religious theory, God intervened in the midst of a war that He, by the way, did not sponsor, that He had no stake in, to make oil in a lamp last 9 days, when allegedly the amount of oil for the lamp was only 1 day. Now, it's not that they didn't have 9 days worth of oil for their lamp. It's just that by religious rules, some of the oil, much of the oil, was impure, and therefore they wanted only pure oil to last during this period of time. And so God's great miracle that has established what is now the most commonly known Jewish holiday is Hanukkah, as a result of this great manipulation of oil. Now, the Jewish religious celebration, and this is a Jewish religious celebration, this is entirely different than Passover, Matzah, Bukurim, Shavua, Teruah, Yom Kippurim, or Sukkah, in that those days are Yahwehs. They are not Jewish holidays. Those days have nothing to do with the Jewish religion and have everything to do with Yahweh's Torah teaching. They're invitations to all of us. But when it comes to Hanukkah, it is strictly Jewish in the sense of Judaism. It is mentioned in the Talmud, as I said, in Shabbat 21b's attribution of an oil lamp that was divinely manipulated to burn for 9 days. And therefore, the depiction of Hanukkah is a corruption of Yahweh's menorah. Yahweh's menorah, his candle stand, is designed to communicate the formula that is the basis of our creation and the basis of our salvation. It is based upon 6 candles, with 1 candle in the center, conveying man, which was conceived on the 6th day, plus God, who is one, equaling God's ideal of perfection. And so the menorah, as it is described in the Torah, is 7 candles, 6 plus 1 in the center. Ah, but the Hanukkah menorah, just like all religious holidays, is a corruption of what God has conveyed to us. It has 9 candles. If you see a 9-candle menorah, walk away from it. It represents religious corruption. Well, you see, this this particular celebration is regarding the Hashemites, the Hashemian dynasty, which is a religious ruling family. They were victorious over the Syrian Greeks, but most importantly over Hellenized Jews. The religious telling of this is mentioned, but barely, in Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2, 1 verse in each of those 2 non-scriptural books. It is not, as I said, consistent with Yah's teaching in any way. For example, when the Torah and the prophets tell us of a victory that was achieved by, for example, Abraham, Moshe, Yahusha, or Dod, there is never a celebration associated with them, nor any annual event to observe in association with them. And yet, the religious Jews, because they came to power, this was an empowerment of the rabbis, it became an Hanukkah, unlike Yah's invitations to meet with him, became an essential part of their religion. Should you just be curious, the prevailing party, the Hasmoneans, ruled semi-autonomously from the Seleucids in Judea from about 140 to 116 BCE, you know, 24 years. Then around 110 BCE, with the Seleucid Empire, this Greek, Syrian, Egyptian empire disintegrating, the Hasmoneans dynasty became fully independent for a short while, because by 63 BCE, the kingdom was conquered by Rome, and it became a client state. It survived under Roman authority until it yielded to the Herodian dynasty in 37 BCE. And even then, Herod the Great, to bolster his legitimacy by marrying a Hasmonean princess. The celebration of Hanukkah, called the Festival of Lights, is an example of what religion and politics do worst. It commemorates war, something that God does not want us to celebrate, therefore the killing of an enemy. It celebrates the integration of religion and politics. A religious family became politically in charge of the Jewish state. So it celebrates the integration of religion and politics and military victories. There is nothing that Yahweh would see more as more of an abomination than this. It is sad. When I was looking at the history, and I, you know, knew most of this, but I decided I'd just check my facts this morning, and I looked up a little bit about the celebration and the basis, the history of Hanukkah. But the third site down, as I Googled it, was this Christian woman promoting what Hanukkah means to Christianity. You just read this kind of stuff, and you just, your skin crawls.
That's laughable. That's laughable.
Oh, it's like Muhammad seeing the rabbinical Jews celebrating Ashura Day, you know, which was a Babylonian holiday, an event very similar to what Christians celebrate today as Easter. And Muhammad got jealous and said, you know, if the Jews are doing it, we're every bit as entitled to do it as they were. And so the Jews were celebrating a pagan Babylonian holiday, Ashura Day. And and Muhammad, covetous of it, said, well, then we're going to celebrate it. And it became the Ashura Day, which is the single most important holiday in Shia Islam. Now, with the... with this Christian.
Isn't that the one where they go out and they beat their head with the knife and cut their heads and so forth?
Yeah. And with the Christianity, they, you know, loving religion, they want to claim everything that was part of Judaism that they like must apply to them. But two.
I hadn't heard that particular one before. I mean, what really, you know, cued me that you don't be running around celebrating Hanukkah is there's only one symbol I know of that we ever see that Yahweh himself actually designed, and it's the menorah.
That's it.
And for somebody to take those seven lights.
Yeah. Now there are seven symbols, seven metaphors that Yahweh uses. So living springs of water, the bread of life, for example, are examples of that. But in terms of you are absolutely correct. In terms of a tangible object that Yahweh specifically designed and gives explicit directions as how to make it so that the symbolism is complete and accurate. It's the menorah. And it has seven candles, six on either side, three on either side, making six, and one in the middle. The reality is that Hanukkah has become the best known and most celebrated Jewish holiday because it enables Jews to be Jewish during Christmas. Welcome back to Shatteringness. There is a notation in one of the eyewitness or historical portraits of Yahusha in the Greek text that says that he was in town during the Festival of Lights. And so there's a bunch of books that have deduced from that he was observing it and therefore was an observant rabbi celebrating the Jewish religion because they know that there is no basis for Hanukkah apart from the Jewish religion. But it's very much like saying that Scott is the longtime producer of the Shatteringness program, who is working today on Thanksgiving, that it's like saying that Scott and I were producing this show on Christmas Day. That is not to say that we are observing Christmas. It's exactly the opposite, that we were about other work, ignoring Christmas. Working on Christmas because we were not observing it and instead doing other things. One of those things being encouraging you not to celebrate it. Let's move to Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is, for the most part, fairly benign. For us to overtly disdain Hanukkah, Christmas, and Easter, Lent, for example, for us to be hostile to these things and hostile to Halloween is paramount. And there is no way you can celebrate Christmas and Halloween and the Easter and be a part of Yahweh's covenant family. They are absolute abomination to him. I would not put Thanksgiving anywhere near that league. So what I'm going to share about Thanksgiving is important for people to know, but it's not because I'm saying that you ought not take advantage of the fact that our society gives this time off each year, and therefore you can gather together with family over a meal and celebrate family. So with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about Thanksgiving. Before I do, Larry, do you have any different perspective on that? Or are you also of the view that capitalize on the fact that most organizations, businesses give you the time off?
I've seen many, many people throw up all kinds of things. It's got to do with slaughtering Indians, this, that. Every time I get to the root of it, like the Pequot Indian story, that's not what it was about. So, you know, in the final end, I can find nothing with pagan roots or anything else that started Thanksgiving. Yeah, okay. I couldn't.
There are pagan roots. And the slaughtering of the Indians rather than celebrating life with them is an important aspect of the story. Thanksgiving was not created with the colonists and the Indians. It was created by Abraham Lincoln in the midst of the Civil War.
I know that. That's where the start was. And the Pequot Indian story is not. Actually, I think it takes place in September or something. I mean, it's just none of it adds up to me.
I'm going to share a number of Indian stories that are coterminous to this time that really are the dominant theme of how the colonists and the Indians interacted with one another in a moment. But first, part of the American revisionist lore that in 1621, the Plymouth colonists and the Wampanoag Indians shared an autumn harvest feast. Autumn harvest feasts are part of every pagan religion. That's just the nature of every pagan religion has in it an autumn harvest feast. And the ideas were to celebrate the harvest of the crops and give, you know, a percentage to the god. And then when you do that, then the next year the god will reward you with another good year of crops. The actual celebration of Thanksgiving as an American holiday, and it is strictly an American holiday now. There's no correlation to the autumn harvest feast that was celebrated with the Indians. It was established in 1863. It was in the midst of the Civil War in Virginia. On the Barclay Plantation. And at the time, Lincoln, who was a disgusting racist, and who never should have led the country into war. He was trying to urge McClellan to be ruthless. He wanted McClellan not to care about the safety of his own troops, but to attack Richmond. And McClellan hesitated, wouldn't do so. And as a result, Lincoln used this time to rally the troops. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. One of the myths that I want to shatter, and we're only going to take a moment and talk about two of the stories. But I do want to talk about the first two encounters between the native peoples of the Americas and the colonialists, because this is a time where the myth is propagated that the colonialists and the native peoples shared a common religious bond and shared a common familial bond, and that they celebrated their relationship together, and that Thanksgiving was born out of that, which is really not true. Thanksgiving was born from the mind of an extraordinarily corrupt, racist politician who was a warmonger, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln in the Lincoln-Douglas debates specifically said that his view of African Americans, and he wouldn't use that term. He used the derogatory term that the program would be shut down today if I used, should be sent off to what was essentially a concentration camp. They should be interned. They should be separated from white people. They should have no dealings with white people, that they were inferior to white people, and so that the solution was to move them into reservations where only they would be around one another. And this holiday was established in the midst of a war to give Lincoln's side an advantage over the Confederacy. Now, let's talk a little bit about the two earliest encounters between Indians and the colonials. Jamestown, founded in 1607, was the site of the first successful English settlement in North America. Down there where you are, of course, it was the Spanish, and they were fairly abusive of the Seminole Indians, but not nearly as abusive as was Andrew Jackson and the three Seminole Wars, but we're not going to talk about them because they take place at a later date. So this was a colony in Virginia. Its economy became principally tobacco because they were unable to find gold. At first, the native population was more than happy to trade provisions to the colonists for metal tools. But in 1609, 2 years after the colony was first established, the English governor, John Smith, had begun to send raiding parties into the Indian camps to demand food. Not to trade for food, but to demand it. This earned the colonists a bad reputation among the Native Americans and precipitated conflict. They isolated the Native Americans. They burned down houses. They stole their food supplies. The English violence served to alienate the Native population even further. So now besieged by those they had terrorized, those they had robbed, those they had abused, the less than admirable colonists within Jamestown Fort were unable to secure more food supplies. As a result of what can only be looked at as immoral behavior, many of the colonists died during what's called the starving time of 1609 and 1610, but they had done this to themselves. Now, the London Company's primary concern was the survival of the colony. In England's best interest, the colonists would have to remain civil with the Powhatan. The English realized that they could only profit, indeed survive, through trade once at least a pretense of peace was restored. However, unlike John Smith or other leaders of Virginia, such as Thomas Dale and Thomas Gates, they acted on a different notion because they were military men and they saw the Powhatan as essentially a military problem. As a result, the Powhatan soon realized that these Englishmen, these destructive, deadly thieves, did not settle in Jamestown to coexist with them or to trade with them. The English wanted more. They wanted control over the land and its inhabitants. The chief of the Powhatan wrote, "Your coming is not for trade, but to invade my people and to possess my country." Chief Powhatan wanted peace among the English and the Indians, so he said, "Having seen the death of all of my people three times, I now know the difference of peace and war better than any other country," end quote. But since he knew that, based upon their greed and savagery, that war with the English was inevitable, Powhatan predicted, "He can neither rest, eat, nor sleep, but his tired men must watch. And even if a twig should break, even one cry, he must fly with miserable fear for the ending of what is now a miserable life." In 1610, the London Company instructed Gates, the newly appointed colonial governor, to Christianize the natives and to absorb them into the colony. As for Chief Powhatan, Gates was told, "If you find him, if you find it not best to make him your prisoner, you must make him your tributary." And all other of his subordinate chiefs about him must acknowledge no other lord but King James. Interesting statement, isn't it, Larry, that King James was the Lord, capital L, and that they were to be Christianized, and to be Christianized, they would have to acknowledge the Lord, King James. And if they did not want to be Christianized, they could be taken prisoner. And if they saw fit that he would not be your prisoner, then you must make them pay tribute to you. This is despicable. This is despicable. Yeah, absolutely despicable. When Gates arrived in
options.
Yeah, fantastic. It sounds like the options of Islam. You can either convert to our religion and worship our king as Lord. You can pay us a tribute tax. It's called the jizya in Islam, or we'll kill you. This was Christianity's version of that. When Gates arrived in Jamestown, he decided to evacuate the settlement because he thought that the government's plan was not feasible. As the colonists were about to leave the bay and head out to the open sea, they were met by the incoming fleet of Lord De La Ware. Taking command as governor, De La Ware ordered the fort reoccupied. He plotted conquest against all of the surrounding tribes. In July 1610, he sent Gates against the Kakolotan. This is a quote. Gates lured the Indians into the open by means of music and dance, act by his drummer. Then he slaughtered them all. End quote. This was the first Anglo-Powhatan War. The English, led by Samuel Argall, captured Pocahontas, daughter of Powhatan, and held her hostage until she would agree to their demands, until he, the king, would agree to their demands. Quote, so this is kidnap for ransom. Islam again, but perpetrated by Christians. Quote, English demanded that all Powhatan captives be released, return all English weapons taken by warriors, and agree to a lasting peace, end quote. It was while Pocahontas was held by the English that she met John Rolfe, whom she later married. While in captivity, Pocahontas was taught the English language, manners, and religion, of course, because religion and manners were coterminous from the colonialist eyes. She was baptized a Christian, not that baptism has anything to do with, and took the name Rebecca. Rolfe wrote that the way to maintain peace between Powhatan and the English was therefore to marry Indians with the unbridled desire of carnal affection, not for the unbridled desire of carnal affection, but for the good of the colony and for the glory of God. So, yes, his marriage of Pocahontas wasn't because he loved her, no, but to glorify God. Such marriage may bring peace between warring English and the Powhatan, but it did not satisfy Pocahontas' desire, according to the English. After they married, there were, however, more peaceful times. However, in 1618, after the death of the king, Powhatan, his brother became the paramount chief of the Confederacy. He did not believe that peaceful relations with the colonists could be maintained. In other words, he was didn't have a daughter that would be killed should he seek to have his people survive the onslaught of the English. Having recovered from his defeat commanding the Ponunki warriors during the First Anglo-Powhatan War, he managed to shock the English with an attack that would leave them contained in a small trading outpost rather than expanding throughout the area with new plantations. In the spring of 1622, after a settler murdered his advisor, the king launched a campaign of surprise attacks on at least 31 separate English settlements and plantations, mostly along the James River. According to the British, the Indian Massacre of 1622 took place in the English colony of Virginia on Friday, the 22nd of March, 1622. Yeah, this would be just months after this glorious celebration of the Harvest Feast in Massachusetts. Captain John Smith, though he had not been in Virginia since 1609, was thus not a first-hand eyewitness, but he related in his History of Virginia that the braves of the Powhatan Confederacy came unarmed into our houses with deer, turkey, fish, fruits, and other provisions to sell us. End quote. Suddenly, the Powhatan grabbed any tools or weapons available to them and killed any English settlers who were within their sight, including men, women, and children. The chief led coordinated series of attacks of the Powhatan Confederacy that killed 347 people, a quarter of the English population of Jamestown. Now, to be fair, the ultimate victors write history, a history that is often contoured and shaded on behalf of the victors. Now, Jamestown was spared due to a timely last-minute warning. The Powhatan also attacked and destroyed many other settlements at the time. Now, according to the British Encyclopedia, during the one-day surprise attack, the Powhatan tribes attacked many of the smaller communities, including Henricus and its fledgling college for children of natives and settlers alike. At Martin's Hundred, they killed more than half of the population. There were only two houses and part of a church that were left standing. 20 women were taken captive. So this is the story. From there, it takes a rather nasty turn. The British, to avenge what had happened, decided that they would savage the Indians, and they did. They killed all of them that they could reach. And as a result, when we look at what the English did to provoke war and the Indian response to them, we find that America was born in blood. If you'd like to join this conversation, it's 877-300-7645. Well, Larry, at the beginning, you mentioned the Pequot Wars. The reason that that is relative to or related to our discussion is that it is the Pequot Indians that that resided in Massachusetts. They are the Indians that have the most to do with the Plymouth colony that is attested to have observed the first Thanksgiving. So while I'm not going to provide the whole history of this war, because we only have 6 minutes in this segment, I'm going to present the conclusion of the war.
I'd just like to add some, if I could, here. When you talk about history rewrites, you know, any time history isn't clear, it really works to everybody's disadvantage.
Correct.
And it's not just the disadvantage of going, saying, oh, look, we came in peacefully and, you know, the Indians loved us and we loved them. Well, we know that's not true. We all grew up watching cowboy and Indian movies, you know.
Right. Yeah, not true. The biggest myth, though, Larry, is really this notion that the first settlers in the Americas were fine, upstanding, religious people who were very peaceful, and
they were religious, but they weren't peaceful, because we know religion doesn't breed peace. But the point being that what I'm saying is that also works to delude the minds of everywhere we go. Even today, wars are promoted with the idea we're going in to be peaceful with the civilians, and we're there to help them. And nothing could be further from the truth. But I'll stop.
Yeah, and when you're religious, you always think that God is on your side and God wants you to fight for him, which is just not true. Let me read this, because it plays right into what you're saying. This is, by the way, it's from Wikipedia. I've edited it a bit. On May 26, 1637, with a force of up to 400 fighting men, Mason, who represented the Massachusetts colonials, attacked the Pequot Indians by surprise. He estimated that 600 or 700 Pequot were there when his forces assaulted their camp.
You're talking about
the Mystic River is where he attacked.
That was actually a combination of a couple other Indian tribes, and I think about 90 militia of people that were settlers, but
yeah.
It was Indians more. It was really more Indians on Indians.
The primary armed force were American colonialists. They had 150 Indians with them, but you're going to soon learn what the Indians did. The Indians would not savage their fellow Indians the way the American colonists did. As a matter of fact, what the Indians who accompanied the raid did is said, "We don't want any part of you. You're way too savage for us." So anyway, Mason attacked this mystic camp by surprise, where the Pequot Indians were. The inhabitants were primarily women and children, because most of the warriors had moved towards Hartford. So when they came to the Mystic Village, it was women, children, and old men. Mason ordered that their enclosure be set fire with all of the inhabitants inside. It made that village no different than a Nazi crematorium during burning Jewish women and children alive. If you open your mind, even today, on this day, which is supposed to commemorate a festival celebrated between Indians and the colonialists, you can hear the screams of the women and children. Justifying this conduct later, Mason declared that the attack against the Pequot was an act of God. He said that his God laughed at his enemies and the enemies of his people to scorn the Pequot in a fiery oven. Thus did the Lord judge among the heathen, filling the mystic with the dead bodies. End quote. Mason insisted that any Pequot attempting to escape the flames should be killed. Of the estimated 700 Pequot residents at Mystic that day, only 7 survived, and they were taken prisoner.
I think they were sold as slaves, by the way.
That is correct. That is correct. It was sickening. This is religion at its very worst, deceitful, destructive, deadly, and damning.
Well, it's also typical of the English land grab. I mean, they intended to control the world, and, you know, through taxes, central banking systems, they pretty well do, you know, very
yes.
Serena.
Yeah, the English in America in the first century of the English invasion into this region that was populated by Native Americans was heinous. This nation was born in blood, and it has conducted 101 wars since that time. We'll be back in a moment.